Two Investigations, No Justice, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Two major reports out today. One blames Jamal Khashoggi's murder on the Saudi state. The other links Russia to the downing of a passenger jet over Ukraine. For the families, it's still about getting justice.
And to me, the most important thing is that I know the truth. Who did it? Why could this happen? How could this happen? Who were responsible?
Also, a new law in Quebec means teachers can't wear a hijab at work.
If I were to go into my classroom tomorrow without my scarf on, I would still be the same teacher. My personality would not change.
Plus, recruiting play-by-play announcers for lesser-spoken languages.
Lavinia Yalovi and Adele Willie.
Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. It's been almost 5 years since Malaysian Airlines Flight 17 was shot out of the sky over Ukraine. But finally, investigators today charged four men with the deaths of all 298 people on board. The suspects are three Russians and one Ukrainian citizen, all with links to the Russian government or to pro-Russian separatist forces in Ukraine. They now face trial in the Netherlands, where most of the victims were from. The investigative group Bellingcat conducted its own investigation of Flight MH17. It identified 12 individuals who were involved to various degrees, including the four charged today. Eric Toller is Bellingcat's lead researcher for Eastern Europe and Eurasia.
So on the Russian side, they're the ones who press the button, so to speak, to launch the missiles. The separatists over in eastern Ukraine, they're the ones who organize the more boring logistics, escort, security, and so on for the missile launcher that had the Russian soldiers inside of it.
Is it clear from your investigation that the people you've identified knew what they were doing?
So they're guilty in the sense that they knowingly brought this extremely powerful anti-aircraft system into eastern Ukraine and deployed it and used it without proper checks and balances. But I say the sliver of innocence in the sense that they didn't actually mean to shoot down a Malaysian airliner. They meant to shoot down a Ukrainian jet. We have from our own research on the chain of command and all that, and we know the name of the guy, Valery Stelmach, you know, older guy who lives in a neighboring town. And he's the one who 2 minutes before the downing said there's a little birdie flying your way, meaning a Ukrainian jet. That's kind of their code name for it. And then 2 minutes later, the missile was launched and the plane was shot down. And just to give you an idea of what the mindset was, the number one problem that the Russians and the separatists had at the time was Ukrainian air power in the region. And that's why the Buk, this anti-aircraft missile system, was deployed and why they were so quick to fire.
A lot of information in Bellingcat's report comes from intercepted phone calls. Who were these phone calls between and how did you get access to them?
They're out for the whole world to see. So the Dutch official investigation has published most of these. They were initially done by the Ukrainian security services, who intercepted these phone calls because they were monitoring this for the war effort. And these were passed on to the Dutch investigators. These phone calls are between the separatist leaders over in eastern Ukraine and also Russian military intelligence and Ministry of Defense personnel.
How did you manage to track down the people in these phone calls?
A lot of times we knew these people already because they're relatively well-known or famous individuals. So Igor Strelkov is this mustachioed guy who everyone knows about. He was probably the most famous commander in eastern Ukraine. He was the minister of defense of the so-called Donetsk People's Republic. But others were a little bit more obscure and harder to find. They all had nicknames and call signs they used during the war. So by following some relatively obscure material, so like abandoned pages on Russian social network accounts, we were able to cross-reference them with one another. So we listened to the voice of a person in one of these intercepted calls and compare it with the voice of what we suspect to be the same person in some interview they gave years ago. And there's this Russian message board called Antikvariat. It's a place for a bunch of mostly old and middle-aged Russian men to talk about developments in the war and share information. And we can gather information about them. It'll be someone's birthday and everyone will wish them a happy birthday. Well, now you know when their birthday is, you can cross-reference that information with other census rolls and voter databases and social media accounts.
What new details have you learned about the crash from these phone calls?
We've had most of these for quite a while, but the new ones that are published today by the Dutch investigators definitely do shed some new light on what we know. For example, there's a phone conversation between Igor Girkin, he's one of the four people who had charges brought against him today by the Dutch prosecution, and some of his Russian handlers, including some very, very high up people like Vladislav Surkov, who is the presidential advisor to Putin. He specifically asked for heavier anti-aircraft equipment with trained crew, because we, as he said, we don't have time to train them ourselves. We need you to send people over who are battle proven and know what to do. And a month later, sure enough, that order was fulfilled, giving the okay for the missile launcher that had the Russian soldiers inside of it. So, I mean, it goes about as high as up you can go. I don't think the Minister of Defense himself knew about this or Putin himself knew about this, but their direct reports were involved in the authorization and transfer of this stuff. You know, it's the equivalent of one of the national security advisors okaying it for the U.S. equivalent.
What details do we still not know about the downing of Malaysian Airlines flight MH17?
The biggest question is exactly who pressed the button. So we know now that there were four Russian crew members that came in the missile launcher that downed MH17. They came from Russia across the border into Ukraine. And we know that these people almost certainly come from the 53rd Anti-Aircraft Brigade, which is an air defense unit that's based in Western Russia. But we don't know who these four people are. We have a list of every single soldier in this brigade at the time, but we don't know which of this long list are these four men. So that is the number one question, along with granular details about who in the Russian Ministry of Defense went up the pecking order to authorize the transfer of this anti-aircraft missile system.
Eric Toler is with the open source investigative group Bellingcat. Family members of the MH17 victims were briefed by Dutch authorities today before the new murder charges were announced. Selena Fredericks was in that group. She lost her son Bryce on MH17. Selena, welcome. And I know it's been 5 years, but I want to tell you how sorry I am about your son.
Yeah, thank you very much.
It had to be an emotional moment to hear this from Dutch authorities.
Yes.
What were you feeling as you sat there waiting for them to speak?
I was very anxious. And when they mentioned the names and we saw the pictures of the people, I cried. It was very emotional.
You know, if you're willing, I'd love to hear about your son, Bryce, what he was like and what excited him, that kind of thing.
Yeah, he loved to play soccer. He loved his girlfriend, Daisy, who was also on the plane with him. He and Daisy always had a lot of fun. They were always joking around and always listening to music, hip-hop, R&B, reggae music. The house was always filled with his music.
He was 23, and what was he doing with his life at that point?
He was working as a cook at events and parties.
What's hard about this case, I imagine, is that these four men have been accused of being responsible for this horrible tragedy, but they're not going to stand trial themselves because they can't be extradited.
Yes.
What does that mean for you?
Well, that was something we knew from the start, so that's not a surprise. I think that GIT did a very good job, and they have a lot of evidence. And to me, the most important thing is that I know the truth. Who did it? Why could this happen? How could this happen? Who were responsible? Of course, I'd like to see people go to jail for it, but if this is the only thing we can get, so be it.
And the JIT is the investigative authority on behalf of the countries who lost people on the plane.
Yes.
Did the authorities show you any evidence that these men intended to shoot down a commercial airliner rather than an enemy warplane?
No. They're not sure, but it seems that it was a mistake. They thought it was a military plane.
Do you feel like the airline itself has some responsibility, given that it went into this airspace?
They sure have. They sure have. First of all, Ukraine should have closed the airspace. They didn't. And second, Malaysia Airlines were flying over a conflict zone where a big war was going on the ground. They took a very big risk. Everybody knew what was going on in the eastern of Ukraine. So, yes.
Do you plan to be at the trial?
Yes. I will definitely be there every time.
What will it mean to you to be there, even though the defendants will not?
It will be very hard. I know that. A very emotional throwback to all the 5 years before. That was last night also. I couldn't sleep. The whole film in my head was playing again from the last 5 years, what happened to the children. I know it's going to be very emotional, but I have to do it. I want to know everything.
Do you have a sort of favorite memory or image of Bryce, a kind of favorite expression or things that you can savor about him?
Yes, him laughing and joking around. He was always joking around. And we always had a lot of discussions. Politics, what was going on in the world, people, music, a lot of talks about music. Actually, he was interested in everything. And especially what was going on in Indonesia. My husband was born in Indonesia. Bryce had been there several times. And he wanted to go there. They were going to Bali. And he wanted to play soccer over there. He already had some appointments for games.
It's a tough question, but I wonder if you could give a message to Russian President Vladimir Putin. What would you say to him, given the difficulty and impossibility of getting these defendants to trial?
Yeah. Don't lie. Just shut up or be honest and take your responsibility.
Selena Friedrichs lost her son Bryce on the airliner shot down over Ukraine in 2014. I want to thank you so much for speaking with me.
You're very welcome. Thank you, too.
An island in far northern Norway is trying to do away with time. For a few weeks, anyway. The World's Sarah Birnbaum explains.
The tiny island of Sommerøy on the Arctic Circle has a period of 69 days when the sun never sets. So this guy named Kjell Ove Verding heads the so-called time-free zone campaign. And he says in the summer months, the traditional routines just don't apply and they shouldn't have to.
People are cutting grass in the night. People are painting their houses at midnight. And people are doing a lot of things that we can't do because it's daylight.
Verding says that the residents of Sommerøy, all 300 of them, have been living this way for years, and now they just want to formalize it. So they submitted a petition to the central government in Oslo to become the first time-free zone. So I was just really intrigued by this idea. So I called the state-run tourist agency that's handling the PR for this. And I asked them, what would this petition look like? And, what exactly would it do? And the answer was, well, no one really knows. But one thing is for sure, it's definitely a successful PR move. The story has been on every major media outlet in the U.S., yes, us included. So it makes you wonder, what is the point of all of this? But it also makes you stop and think about a couple of things. It makes you think about, one, could you live outside of time? Like, is that even possible? How would you make an appointment? How would you watch a TV show? And even in Sommerøy, Verding admits you can't completely shield yourself from time.
I know that you can't say to the plane, you will go when I come to the airport. But I will say that 60-70% of 24 hours, you don't need the clock.
Sommerøy is so different from the East Coast. And I guess that's the larger message here. We're always hustling to get places. It's the story of my life. But the pace is just different in the Arctic Circle. And they place a value on that. And I think that's a good lesson for all of us. For the world, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
A new law that bans some public employees in Quebec from wearing religious symbols at work is immediately challenged. That story is up next here on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. A new law in Quebec makes it illegal for some public employees to wear religious symbols at work. That means no crosses, for example, and no yarmulkes, turbans, or hijabs. The law applies to a wide range of public employees, from police officers and public school teachers to judges and lawmakers themselves. The measure, called Bill 21, was passed on Sunday, and it's already being challenged by civil liberties and Muslim groups. Though the law does not explicitly mention any religion by name, Canadian Muslims believe the ban is aimed at Muslim women who wear the head covering. Nadia Naqvi is a school teacher in Quebec who wears the hijab. Nadia, now you are actually exempt from this new law. Why is that?
It's because I have a permanent post. I have what we call tenure. I've been permanent with the school board for about 9 years, and so I've been grandfathered in.
So you're exempt from this new law, you're grandfathered in, but that hasn't stopped you from speaking out against the ban. Why is that?
because I'm in a very, what I would call a privileged situation. Because in Quebec, we have two systems. We have the English system and the French system. The English system, we are more global. And while we're not as diverse, we're a little bit more accepting of diversity. My principal has encouraged me to talk. I'm sitting very comfortably in a tenured position. I see the trouble that these young girls that are coming up, they're just about to finish their teaching degree. They're in their early 20s and they have no one to turn to. And if I don't speak up, who will?
Are you the only teacher at your school who wears the hijab?
Oh, yes.
And what kind of reaction have you received at your school?
Oh, it's been extremely, frankly, amazing. My school, along with three other high schools, organized a walkout, a concurrent walkout, and my kids and students that I hadn't even taught, I don't even have the words. I still get goosebumps. They were incredibly passionate about it. They couldn't understand what the big deal was. And these are still children. They saw me as a teacher who taught them all about the human body. And at the same time, I happen to wear a hijab.
And you're a science teacher. You teach ninth grade science?
Yes, I teach. The theme for grade nine science and technology is human physiology and the technology that's associated with it.
Now, I also wonder, have you ever gotten negative reaction for wearing the hijab at your school?
No, not from colleagues. I do get a gut feeling once in a while from some parents, but it's never been, you know, outright. But on a daily basis, no, I've always had extremely positive relationships with my students. I can confidently say that I'm one of the most popular teachers at my school.
Wow. Are there other teachers or staff at your school who wear other kinds of religious symbols?
Of course, there's teachers who wear wedding bands. That's been questioned. I have one colleague who is a practicing Christian, and he said, bring it on. I want them to see my wedding band as a religious symbol because I was married in a church.
But this won't apply to wedding bands. It applies more to, you know, yarmulkes, turbans, hijabs, crosses.
No, because nothing has been defined yet. We don't know.
When will that be illuminated? In reading about it, it suggests that it's more kind of outward symbols that are directly associated with a particular religion.
That's what they're saying. That's their vague way of, you know, pointing the finger at Muslim women, which frankly, our society has been uncomfortable with Muslim women for a very long time. Why is this such a big problem? We don't have that many people wearing religious symbols anyways. And there's no data to show that it makes a difference. If I were to go into my classroom tomorrow without my scarf on, I would still be the same teacher. My personality would not change.
All right. Nadia Naqvi is a school teacher in Quebec who wears the hijab. Thanks so much, Nadia.
Thank you so much.
China has been targeting Muslim citizens for surveillance and persecution. It's believed to be detaining up to 1 million Uyghurs and other Muslim ethnic minorities in the far west region of Xinjiang. We have a story about one Uyghur family whose members fled Xinjiang and ended up opening a restaurant just outside of Boston. Here's the story from my WGBH colleague, Anna Kusmer.
Monday morning is the slowest time of the week at Silk Road in Cambridge. The chefs prep in the back, sharpening knives and making the dough for their signature hand-pulled noodles. Adila Sadir opened the restaurant in 2017 with her brother-in-law.
Not many people know about Uyghur in this area, so we want to present our culture and our cuisine here.
Uyghurs are a mostly Muslim ethnic minority from Xinjiang in northwestern China, but their culture and cuisine is closer to Central Asia, lots of rice pilaf and lamb. When Silk Road opened, Sadir says most people who came in didn't know much about Uyghurs. Now they're asking a lot of questions.
I had a couple customers, they just stopped by and asked my family situation and say, oh, nice stuff, kind thing. So that makes me really happy. Like some people really, they stop by just for, like, support us.
Sadir is 27. She's here in the U.S. with her mom, younger brother, and sister. But her father is back in Xinjiang. He's among the 1 million Uyghurs believed to be imprisoned in what China calls re-education camps. They're cut off from their families, not allowed to speak their language or practice Islam. Sadir's father has been detained since June. The last time she heard from him was in November.
I worry about my father so much, but I don't know. There's no way I can help him or someone to help him. My father did nothing wrong. just because he's Muslim, he's Uyghur, he got into the camp.
Sadir says she used to think if she kept quiet, Chinese authorities would let her father go.
In the beginning, my father missing, I didn't speak out anything. I would just wait, hope my father would get out like in 1 month or 2 months. I wait.
In December, she stopped waiting and went public. She started posting on Facebook in Mandarin with the hashtag MeTooUyghur.
I post videos, pictures online and social media like Facebook and speak out for my father.
When I ask if she worries this might put her father in danger, she says he's already in danger. She says sometimes people respond to her posts with pictures of their own family members who are being held in camps. Sadir says when she comes to work at the restaurant, she avoids talking politics. She estimates around 60% of her clientele are Chinese, mostly local students. She says she doesn't talk to them about what's happening back home, and they don't ask. The only non-Uyghur working at Silk Road is Jackie Lim, Sadir's best friend who works in the kitchen.
I'm American-born Chinese, ABC.
Lin grew up outside of Boston and spent years working in local restaurants.
Before I worked there, I never heard of Uyghur. But then after I worked there, like, they became my family and everything.
Lin says he feels terrible about what Sadir and her family are going through, and he supports them. He also posts online with hashtag MeTooUyghur. And Sadir's mom has taught Lin some fundamentals of Uyghur cooking, like hand-pulling noodles.
So we just got the dough. We just let it chill, let it sit, and then we have to hand roll it.
When the noodles are done, the chef fries them in a big wok with vegetables, lamb, and a dozen spices and sauces. Sadir has lived in the Boston area for almost 10 years, but she still refers to Xinjiang as home. She wants more people to know what's happening there.
If I didn't do anything, I will feel regret. I should fight for my father.
Sadir says she knows speaking to me, a reporter, could put her and her family in danger. But she's done being quiet. For The World, Anna Kussmer, Cambridge, Mass.
I'm Carol Hills. A UN investigator doesn't flinch in blaming the Saudi government for the gruesome murder of Jamal Khashoggi.
My report demonstrates the responsibilities of the state of Saudi Arabia, not of individual officials who may have carried the rogue operations.
That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. A new United Nations report holds Saudi Arabia responsible for the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi last year. But the real news is this. The document says there's credible evidence to investigate Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and other top Saudi officials for murder. Khashoggi was killed inside the kingdom's consulate in Istanbul, Turkey, and the new report draws on grisly audio Turkish authorities provided to UN officials. It also describes Saudi agents discussing the dismemberment of Khashoggi's body. Officials in Saudi Arabia have slammed the UN report and dismissed its claims. The World's Shirin Jafari is here in the studio with more on this really damning report. Hey, Shirin.
Hey, Carol. This report took about 5 months to complete, and it was done by a woman called Agnes Callimard. She's the special rapporteur for the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. And this report is important because it's the first independent investigation into the murder of Jamal Khashoggi.
So what are the key takeaways from the report?
The biggest takeaway and what everyone is talking about is that the report says there is credible evidence that point to the involvement of the state of Saudi Arabia in this murder. For example, Agnes Callimard says the murder took place inside the consulate. You know, that's a government building. The suspects use consulate cars to get to the location and leave afterwards. Some of the men involved in the operation took a private jet, and that private jet had diplomatic clearance to fly to Turkey. Here's Agnes Callimard in an interview with the BBC today.
So this and many other evidence point to the responsibility of the state of Saudi Arabia.
Is Agnes Callimard suggesting that the Crown Prince himself was involved?
You know, the purpose of this report wasn't exactly to establish blame, but it does conclude that the killing was deliberate, it was premeditated, and that there is enough credible evidence to warrant more investigation. And Carol, some of the evidence in this report is extremely grim. Kalimar had access to some of the audio that was recorded inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. The report gives a chilling minute-by-minute description of what happened. Khashoggi is heard in a conversation with the men who allegedly took his life.
It really must have been a challenging investigation.
Oh, absolutely. The Saudi government didn't let the special rapporteur visit the kingdom for her investigation. She only had access to some of the audio that was recorded in the Saudi consulate in Turkey. Plus, as you know, the crime scene was completely scrubbed after Khashoggi was killed. So a lot of the evidence was lost, and Jamal Khashoggi's body hasn't been found yet.
What's been the reaction to the report inside Saudi Arabia?
Well, today, Reem Dafa, the vice president of the Saudi American Public Relations Affairs Committee in Riyadh, said that the Saudi state has nothing to do with Khashoggi's murder. She was talking to the BBC and the presenter asked her about the role of the Saudi state.
That's where it becomes wrong. With the word state, there cannot be the word state in that sentence, especially with the judicial system carrying out a very, very swift judicial system within Saudi Arabia.
Dafa said that the Saudi judicial system is in the process of bringing these people who are responsible for Jamal Khashoggi's murder to justice, but that this process just takes long.
Okay, the big question, of course, is does a report like this have any teeth?
Like I said, this is the first independent investigation into Jamal Khashoggi's death, so that's important. And then there's something else that this report does, and that is that it draws global attention to Jamal Khashoggi's case again. You know, it's been 8 months since Khashoggi was killed, and, you know, as more time passes, people start to forget, and they start to pay less attention. And in the U.S., sometimes it does seem like people have moved on. For example, just this month, the Trump administration gave the okay to two American companies to share sensitive information about nuclear power with the Saudis. Some lawmakers have been outraged and they have been trying to stop this, but so far they haven't been getting much traction.
So what's next now that this report has been released?
Well, Agnes Callimard wants more investigations. She's even asked the FBI to open its own probe into the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. And she wants the Saudi government to stop its investigation because she feels like it doesn't have much credibility. And next week, she's going to present her report to the Human Rights Council in Geneva. I read that Jamal Khashoggi's fiancé is also going to be there.
Just an unbelievable story. The World's Shireen Jafari. Thanks.
Anytime, Carol.
There were more than 70 million displaced people around the globe last year, more than 70 million forced to live away from their homes by war, violence, and persecution. That's the highest number in decades, according to the UN. Syria's civil war alone has displaced at least 6 million, many of them members of families who are now scattered in many different countries. Families like the Zidias.
Hi, Samer. How are you?
It has been a while.
Yeah.
How's your kids?
Very good. They are very good.
They are in the school now?
Yeah, Tim is in his school and Maya in the daycare.
Oh, in the daycare.
Yeah.
Those were Hiba and Samer, two of six siblings in the Zidia family. 6 years ago, they were forced to flee their Syrian hometown, Daraa, when it became a center of the Syrian civil war. The family is now spread across six different countries. Hiba is the youngest sibling. She's 27 and living now in Ontario, Canada, in the town of Brampton. Her older brother, Samer, is 38. He's now in Beirut, Lebanon. We reached out and spoke to them together. They say that for the longest time, their lives revolved around their family home in Syria, and specifically around a weekly tradition.
We were gathering every Friday at our parents' home and spend the whole day together, make lunch and tell our stories during the week. We were having a lot of fun.
My mother and my old sister, who's the one who's responsible to prepare these traditional foods, it's very delicious and it means a lot for me, not just a food. It means love. It means gathering. It means that we have a mom or have a dad and our kids play together. They can see each other.
in our family especially, we were very close to each other. When I left Syria, I was just like 19 years old, and I used to live with them, all of them. Suddenly, I found myself alone, just with my husband, no brothers, no sisters. So I struggled a lot, we suffered a lot, because sometimes I really want to see them, I really want to see Samer and see their children.
Before Canada, Hiba was with her mother and father in Jordan. Samer wanted to visit from Lebanon. He's an architect and could afford it, but couldn't get permission, even when his father fell ill and was on his deathbed.
I tried many times to go to the Jordan embassy here in Beirut, trying to have a visa, and they said we don't have the application to the Syrian because you can't enter Jordan freely. So I suffered a lot while my father, he was in the intensive care for 10 days before he passed away. This is one of the most difficult moments that I suffered after the conflict broke out. And the second one, when the daughter of my young brother in Denmark, she was born and unfortunately she was passed away in Denmark and I didn't see her. She suffered from a cancer. And there is no way to travel to Denmark.
I'm so sorry.
I'm sorry also to share this sad stories with you, but this is a fact. And now we are suffering because we cannot find a country or a spot of land on the entire world to reunite as a family. Usually the Syrian could enter Turkey and they can reunite as a whole family for weeks, days. Now, we cannot have the opportunity to have a country in all the entire world that I can enter it. My brother from Denmark, my sister from Canada, my other sister from United Emirates, or my sister in Germany. We cannot find this part of the entire world to reunite.
Hey, but what do you do to stay connected to your siblings? Do you talk to Samer much?
Yeah, I talk to them very much. And we have a group on WhatsApp. Almost every day, we send pictures for our children, for ourselves. And we try to make sure that everything is good. All of them are in a good situation.
I don't think you can believe me that I spend weekly 1 hour or 2 hours watching a video, watching our picture when we were together. I laugh loudly when I saw one of the videos that we are playing or we are just kidding.
I really miss him. I really miss his kids. When I lay to bed and want to sleep, I always see her pictures.
Pictures and videos is the only stream of life that could give us the hope that we can reunite as a whole family in the future.
I know. Smile. Juju. Hamar.
Siblings Hiba and Samer Zidia. She's in Canada, he's in Lebanon. Their family was forced to leave Syria 6 years ago. Learn more about how families like the Zidias stay connected after war tears them apart. That's at theworld.org. The wars of the future will no doubt produce as much suffering as the ones today, but the weapons may change a lot. The Center for Public Integrity is producing a series of stories on the future of war. And their first story is about the development of new hypersonic weapons. It appears in today's New York Times. R. Jeffrey Smith is the author. Jeffrey, what makes these hypersonic weapons so revolutionary?
Their speed and their maneuverability are the two principal qualities. The speed between 15 and 20 times the speed of sound means that, as you said, if you've heard it, you're probably safe because it's missed you or it's hit another target. Ordinarily, if it's aimed at you, you would not hear it. It would arrive before you had a chance to hear the trailing sonic boom. And it would arrive in a kind of a blinding, catastrophic impact with about 3 to 4 tons of TNT as force. Doesn't need a nuclear warhead, although the Russians are building them with nuclear warheads. The Americans and the Chinese don't seem to be. And what makes them so unique, in addition to the speed, is the fact that they can maneuver. Most missiles follow a ballistic trajectory, which is kind of like if you're an outfielder in center field and you're waiting for a baseball, it is following a ballistic trajectory. It flies in a loop. And pretty quickly after it's been hit, you can roughly guess where it's going to land. These are more like a knuckleball. The attacker knows where they're going, but the people on the receiving end could only guess that they might be striking anywhere within an area the size of Rhode Island, for example. That's how much they can maneuver at the end. And you can't protect everything in Rhode Island. So there's basically no reliable defense against these.
How will they be used? I mean, what's a possible scenario?
Well, hypersonic missiles are ideal for waging a decapitation strike. Someone from the Obama administration's White House called them, in an interview with me, called them instant leader killers. So they could be used in many different ways. And the fact that they have typically, in the American and Chinese versions, they have non-nuclear warheads means that you're not crossing the nuclear threshold when you use them. That makes them more likely to be used than nuclear arms.
Seems like there's also some hazards associated with this. The fact that they are so fast means that there's no time for an adversary to do anything. And couldn't it also precipitate an exaggerated response? You know, it seems a little reckless.
Well, the UN has looked at this, and they said in a February report that having these things around in many countries might make everyone jittery, and that might cause them to put their nuclear forces on alert more often and to use them more quickly, because they would fear that these things could be used against their effective retaliation. So it produces what's called use it or lose it pressures. If you think that your defensive weapons or retaliatory weapons are going to be easily attacked in a first strike, you're more likely to launch them before they can be attacked. That means that in a crisis, if two countries are both nervous about what the other might do, one might be provoked to act merely by the suspicion or the fear that hypersonic missiles could be launched against them.
Ultimately, is this kind of weapon supposed to be a deterrent, like it's a weapon you make but you're never going to use, or would it be used?
We're going to find out. We don't know.
R. Jeffrey Smith is with the Center for Public Integrity. He's the author of a piece on hypersonic weapons in today's New York Times. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for your interest.
Read more about this investigation from the Center for Public Integrity and the New York Times. Their investigative reporting on hypersonic weapons is on our Facebook page. We're at PRI The World. Systemic failure. That's how the United Nations is describing its own handling of the Rohingya crisis in Myanmar. Hundreds of thousands of Rohingya have escaped violence and persecution in Myanmar over the last decade. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres asked for a review of how his agency responded. The news was not positive. John Sifton is with Human Rights Watch. John, according to the review, what did the UN get wrong?
The United Nations failed to elevate human rights concerns to the leadership level, buried information that humanitarians on the ground had gathered at great risk. And keep in mind, this is the second time there's been a report like this in the context of a mass killing, because a similar, much more scathing report was issued after the 2009 violence in Sri Lanka that claimed the lives of tens of thousands of people at the end of Sri Lanka's civil war. That report was even more scathing than this report and resulted, unfortunately, in no serious reforms.
Now, this review is pretty scathing. I mean, it uses terms like obviously dysfunctional performance, a culture of mistrust, mixed and incomplete signals coming from the field. Can you be more clear on what happened here?
Yeah.
Would people go to a supervisor, say, this is what's going on the ground, and the supervisor ignore it? Kind of what was happening?
Yeah, so the UN is not a monolithic institution. There are separate agencies. And what essentially happened here is that key officials in certain departments, like people tasked with the humanitarian and emergency response, the people tasked with human rights, their inputs were being ignored or suppressed by what they call the coordinator on the ground. And so that was resulting in poor information flowing into New York at the leadership level.
Why was this happening? Why was the information not being passed on?
It's a systemic problem, not just with the United Nations, but with the humanitarian world, where because of the quest for access to populations in need and the thought that if you lose that access, people in need won't get life-saving aid and emergency assistance. Now, it's understandable. There's, you know, a desire to get access to populations in need, but it can't come at the expense, larger expense of human rights. And that is the lesson of Sri Lanka that was disregarded in Burma.
And what were the consequences of that?
Well, the consequences is that you now have a situation where Burma has learned that they can be recalcitrant and get away with it. And it's been asked if others are to blame. And absolutely, the United Nations is not alone. Many countries, although they spoke about their outrage at what was going on, they failed to bond together and lay down tough terms to the Myanmar government. Say, you know, if you don't start cooperating with the United Nations, there are going to be real-world consequences, sanctions, travel bans, and the like.
So what now? I mean, we've got this information. How do we avoid this happening again?
We don't have any accountability. The report talks about collective responsibility, but really it's individual responsibility. The individuals who are involved in this mess need to be fired, not promoted, not shuffled into a new post in some other country, but fired.
John Sifton is the Asia Advocacy Director for Human Rights Watch. Thanks a lot, John.
Thank you.
At the Women's World Cup in France, there's a group of women making news off the soccer pitch. For the first time in history, three women from the Pacific Islands of Fiji and Vanuatu are doing live commentary of the games. And in another first, they're doing it in their native languages. Reporter Rebecca Rossman caught up with them in Montpellier, France.
Adele Willey and Janessa Hinge Mole are from Vanuatu, an archipelago nation in the South Pacific. Lavenia Yolovi is from neighboring Fiji. They're lined up across a single bed inside a cramped hotel room here in Montpellier, listening to their first Women's World Cup commentary, a game between New Zealand and the Netherlands.
What I like is the tone of my voice.
Yeah.
Like, I just keep high bar, that commentator tone.
Remember, the word we were using was crispness. You've got to get in quickly with your idea, communicate it crisply, and get out because you're in a...
That's Aaron Carney, who is mentoring these fledgling commentators.
That's never a fun exercise, listening back.
The women aren't commentating today, but they're still at work. And, ooh, it's making them cringe a bit.
So let's try and find three things that we like and three things that we can work on.
Yes, goal for Netherlands!
A year ago, the three women were recruited to participate in a pilot program backed by the Australian government. The goal? Recruit more female broadcasters to provide sports commentary in more languages.
Crowd, let me just go crazy now at this time. Let me go from...
Lavenia Yolovi has played on three of Fiji's national sports teams, but she'd never thought about turning that experience into commentating. Then she received a call from Aaron Carney. He was looking to put a team together.
And then later on he called me and he said, I'm still looking for two more participants from Fiji. You want to take it up? I said, okay. So, like, giving it a try?
In November of last year, Lavenia and her fellow commentators made history when they produced their first live broadcast at the Oceania Nations Cup. Adele and Janessa spoke in Bishlama, a Creole language that's also an official language of Vanuatu, while Lavenia spoke in Fijian.
In English, that simply means... Bula Vinaka, if you're listening from Fiji, this is the game between Netherlands and New Zealand. It's been a good game. Game are going on strong.
After the Oceania Nations Cup, they were invited by FIFA to participate in another first, the Women's World Cup.
New Zealand, I play Canada. I Stade des Alpes, Grenoble. I match day two.
Here in France, the women are calling the New Zealand matches. New Zealand are the Pacific champions who beat Fiji late last year to qualify for the World Cup. Even though Fiji didn't qualify, Lavenia thinks Fijians back home are following her commentaries.
It brings the connection back to my country, my language, culture, and also it enables those that are far away from the cities that can't see, can't view things on television, probably tuning in and say, oh, I know this one. oh, this one belongs to my village, this one come from Fiji, and those that identify to what you're saying, or who you are, or the work that you do, or probably you've touched their lives in whatever ways, and hopefully that will motivate and boost their morale.
If you're from a small Pacific island, big things, nice things, the grand show, it doesn't belong to you.
This is mentor Aaron Carney again.
The fact that they are speaking their indigenous language or the language that is spoken on the street, it's such a validation that their culture and their language and their way of doing things is welcome at the big show. If it is a World Cup, then their part of the world should be there.
Thank you to Ms. Lavinia, Mo Adele, supposed to sub Lizinica, Meme.
The plan for future tournaments is to recruit more female commentators speaking underrepresented languages around the world. For the world, I'm Rebecca Ronsman in Montpellier, France.
Me group E match day two. But you try name broadcast with them.
The trio will be calling tomorrow's World Cup match between New Zealand and Cameroon. See photos of them at work at theworld.org. And that's it for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.